now we're at a point where there's a whole generation of people that are coming to grips with the fact that we need to change everything about everything that we do, and we need to do it fast.
And I think that's just a wonderful frame or concept for all of us living in the world to periodically just take a moment and take these models and just say, you know, everything I think I know about the world, I'm going to temporarily suspend it, and I'm just going to be open. And when that happens, we can be present and learn in a way that it's not possible when we're just trying to reinforce our models.
I was invited by the innovative and prestigious Active Inference Institute to host an all-star academic panel where questions explored are, what's the difference between building a model and building a narrative? What about the relationship between predictions and what constitutes you? So that is personal identity. You're going to hear from top neuroscientist Carl Friston at the University of College London, Anna Lemke, who's a professor of psychiatry at the Stanford Addiction Clinic and author of Drug Dealer and Dopamine Nation, links to which are in the description. You'll also hear from Raphael Kaufman, who's the CTO of Digital Gaia. You'll hear from Bert De Vries, who's a professor at Eindhoven University of Technology. Lastly, you'll hear from Guillaume Demas, who is an associate researcher in computational psychiatry at the University of Montreal. So my neighbor. Because why? I am Kurt Jaimungal, and my background is in mathematical physics from the University of Toronto, which is where I'm based. And the whole project of this channel is to analyze various theories of everything, usually in the physics sense, that are proposed, including grand unification with gravity plus dualities and other schemes, as well as what constitutes consciousness. You can find this podcast by typing in Theories of Everything onto YouTube or whichever podcast catcher you have, or you can just click the subscribe right here. The links to the Active Inference Institute are in the description as well. A special thank you to Daniel Friedman for putting this all together. Enjoy. Okay, now speaking of the brain as a computer, we frequently hear in these circles the brain as a predictive machine. Where does this, the quote-unquote brain as a predictive machine, have its limits? And also, is that to be interpreted as implying conscious experience is a predictive machine as well? Okay, and if not, why not? I think, Carl, you'd be a great person to start this off, and then we'll go around the table again.
Yeah, I was just mindful of Mao's presentation, the path to half hour, and the notion of temporal thickness. I'm sure that's got a lot to do with the necessary conditions for the kind of consciousness I'm guessing you're referring to, you know, that freedom from the moment. And if one reads prediction in its sort of psychological or pretension nature in terms of being able to predict what will happen in the future, I think that the that's going to be a sort of a key bright line between things that do not possess a certain kind of sentience and things that do, and that bright line just rests basically upon from perspective of active inference, having a generative model that includes the consequences of your own actions in the future. So just by having consequences, you're now talking about the future, and the cause, the consequences in the future now become random variables. Therefore, you have to infer them, which leads you directly to the notion of planning as inference, which means that bright line is just the difference between things that plan and do not plan. I would guess that that's where you probably want to start in terms of foregrounding the role of prediction as being an aspect of self-organization and its sort of reading under active inference that characterizes conscious things from non-conscious things, namely the ability to plan. Does that make sense?
I have follow-up questions. We'll get to them at some point. For now, Anna, do you have any comments on that, and Bert as well afterward?
Well, you know, I'm new to this field, so I'm just familiarizing myself even with the language. But I can respond to the question, the brain as a predictive machine, in terms of the work that I do clinically and the kind of psychopathology that I see when I'm working with patients. I work primarily with narrative, the stories that they tell about their lives. And one of the recurring themes I've seen through my work is that when patients tell stories in which they are perpetually the victims of other people's actions or the world, they tend to then That tends to be a predictive model for them, so that they will then go out into the world and unconsciously create scenarios which will perpetuate their victimhood. And that part of getting into wellness is to stop seeing themselves as entirely the victim of other people or circumstance, and instead begin to appreciate what they contribute to their life problems. So I guess when I think of the limits of the brain as a predictive machine, I think in some ways, one of the big limits is that it's a very powerful predictive machine that actually allows us to subsequently shape what actually happens to us and or our perceptions of what happens to us, which then can perpetuate a false narrative. And I'll just give one small example from my own life. I've had my conflicts with my mother, and one of my beefs about her is that she's a very poor communicator, and that whenever I email her, I either get a cryptic response or no response at all, and it drives me crazy. And about 5 years ago, she sent an email, asked me some questions. I wrote her back and responded, and it was clear to me that required yet a response from her, which I never got. And that then perpetuated my narrative about her as a very poor communicator and many other negative things. And then about 3 months after I sent that email, I found the email in my draft box. So I had never actually responded to my mother's email. I hadn't actually sent the email. And that was for me just a personal, wonderful example of the ways in which our actions can actually be manipulated to support our models and perpetuate falsehoods about the world that we live in.
Right. And I have a quick question, Bert, just for Anna before we get to you. So you used the word narrative there. How are you defining the word narrative? Is it the same as model? Is it a sequence of events? Like, what is the specific definition of narrative?
You know, I never really thought about it in those terms, but when I talk about narrative, I'm talking about the stories that people tell about their lives, because that's sort of my data, and also about models, because what I've discovered about self-narrative is it's not just a way to organize the past, it also becomes a roadmap for the future. That's the language that I use, but I see it maps very nicely onto your all's language of modeling the world.
I see. Professor DeVries, please.
It's clear that the ability to predict is the essence of intelligent decision making. I have a different background, right? I'm not a psychiatrist, so I think about these things in different ways. The thing that I think about when I think about prediction is I would assume that brain predicts far ahead, that things get less accurate, right? If I predict that I want to go 3/4 around a roundabout, I don't care about the centimeter where my car goes when I'm around there. I just want to get in the right lane. And I would assume that the brain doesn't take much, it takes less computations if you care about things less precisely. But that's very hard in a computer. We have, and this is what kind of kills us in our current way of implementing active inference. When we want to predict a deep path, we don't care about the accuracy, but we don't know how to do it much cheaper when things are less accurate. And so that's still a problem that we need to be working on. It might be a key to building or to scaling up active inference agents if we can actually compute messages that we want to know that we don't care about if they are less precise, that we also spend much less computation on them.
Thank you. Now, Professor Kaufman.
I am not a professor, but I'll answer anyway. They just call me Rafa, Rafa. There's so many really interesting avenues here, and it's not often that I get the pleasure of discussing this kind of stuff with this kind of diverse crowd. But I've been interested in these questions for a pretty long time, and I think what comes to mind is like how active inference as a lens for instance, it enables us to get another sense of what non-dualist views on consciousness are saying when they get us experientially to notice the difference between what we actually perceive and what we between the various processes or things that are going on in our head and our tendency to like lump them all together into the same. Okay, this is my experience that I'm immersed in. So noticing, being able to notice this difference between the process of perceiving and acting, and to what extent it's automated, and the narrative or the various narratives that are going on in parallel in my head, whether I'm aware of them or not, and our ability to just put kind of seemingly arbitrary meta levels on top of it to try to make sense of it all and to force that experience of having multiple narratives and multiple framings going on at the same time makes sense of that experience in a way that aligns with our presuppositions about how things are. So I think that's super interesting. I also wanted to highlight that this view of consciousness as being kind of defined by having a narrative or an internal model that's about self, or that at least is about self, and that leads, as Carl said, to the planning as inference. That's actually like super deflationary in a way that people are not used to thinking about it, and so it's an exciting, it's opening the door to all sorts of exciting interdisciplinary conversations to be had on the basis of, at least I feel like better, less talking past each other than we've ever had. So I'm excited about that.
Sure. And how is it that you're using the word deflationary there? Carl, I remember I asked you about that when we had our podcast together. But Raphael, similar question. So you said deflationary view when we have narratives of self. Do you mean it relegates us to something that consciousness is much less than?
Yeah. I mean, it's not necessarily much less than in the subjective sense, but it's perhaps much less than in the scientific sense. So one example of like one, not saying exactly that, but maybe something close to what Daniel Dennett calls heterophenomenology, which is basically the statement that the sum of what one can say scientifically about consciousness is equal to what can be studied and modeled and theorized and communicated and learned and agreed upon on the basis of objective data about what people, including you, but other people say about their experience, and of course, like what can be measured off neural correlates and whatever, which is not the same as our experience of our direct, what we think is our direct experience of being conscious, right? So one way to look at it is that the science of consciousness doesn't necessarily have to put the primacy on people. For instance, people saying they have qualia that we thought. In that sense, it's deflationary, right? It's you have to explain why people believe they have qualia, not why people have qualia, because it's not necessarily a scientific truth that people have qualia, right?
Professor Dumas.
So, well, on the limits of Breyer's predictive machine, well, we should be always careful to not move from one map territory fallacy to another one, for sure. So we need to be skeptics and avoid to reify the methods. And, well, this World Symposium show how this metaphor is super useful and fruitful. But I can see like two main limits, or at least things where we should be careful. So following what Professor Lemke said, like in psychiatry, I think the looping effects and the way people picture themselves can be very unpredictable. And so the way we think about the brain as a predictive machine, I think prediction for patients would have different signification of what we mean by predictive machines
in the context of active inference. And in general, also like, I can see that certain, psychologists or anthropologists would have a big appeal all of a sudden for, active inference and free energy principles. But taking the words, directly what they think the word mean, well, it needs to be, we need to be careful in the way to communicate it. And typically, following also, what Professor De Vries said about, prediction as being super important for decision making. I think like, we should be careful about the weirdness of, cognitive science and how, it doesn't necessarily expand to, non-Western educated, industrialized country where maybe the cultural value is not about optimization of your decision making or your, profit. And so that's the first thing where I think we should be careful. It's more like a matter of how to communicate the theory in that case, not necessarily a limit of the theory itself. But the second one is, about the equivalence or not with other frameworks. So like, I can see how we had Mao Alvasin talking about category theory. And I'm very curious about right now among the different frameworks that are out there, how can we define what is equivalent or not with active inference to be able to see those limits. Maybe we are leaving what happened with quantum mechanics in the early 20th century with different interpretation, with different tools to model quantum mechanics. And here with artificial intelligence and cognitive neuroscience, we have also all those frameworks. And I think the limitation would be then to not take this interpretation as the only one, but try to have a crosstalk and a differential diagnosis of which one the best for explaining what.
Okay, now my role is the moderator, but I would like you all to speak to one another. So I'm going to ask a question that will serve as, well, you each will speak on it, but as the other people are speaking, just think, okay, is there a question that I have or is there a comment that I have? So the question is, what are some of the recent advancements or breakthroughs in your respective fields that you find particularly promising? And, well, recent, let's say 2020 till now. So we'll start off with Raphael. You're smiling and you look like you're champing.
Oh, I was thinking, what is my field, right? Because we're very much in the last mile of applying the wonderful stuff that y'all come up with and making it useful on the ground. But so I'm extraordinarily excited about research like what BERT is doing, and feel like as Guillaume was saying, we're also starting to see some convergence on different ways to get to the same at least to the same shape of answers, and in some cases even to the same results. So like one example of this is work that Chris Fields, Carl, and others have been doing on the quantum basically explaining quantum information theory and how it relates to the free energy principle, looking at the free energy principle as the classical limit of quantum information theory. And I don't pretend to understand all of it, but as somebody who is coming from a quantum physics background, being alive to see this kind of convergence happening, which as I mean, as Guillaume said, you know, we've been at this business of like post-classical, what the hell is going on for over a century now. And it's nice to be at a time where again, we're starting to talk less past each other. And that's from a theoretical perspective. From a practical perspective, I think just finding that we have all the building blocks to create fast, interpretable, reliable, and aligned decision-making systems which includes AI systems, autonomous systems that have all those characteristics. And that it turns out that all the things that the reinforcement learning and the neural networks people thought were very hard or impossible are sort of in the realm of what we can do, looking at things from an active inference lens, and vice versa. A lot of things that active inference models have incorporated so far. It turns out if you toss in a neural network approximator here, borrow some other, you know, massively parallel computation techniques, it also becomes feasible. So it's converging.
Yeah, for me, what's remarkable is that there's so many domains of what we thought was exclusively human or would be exclusively human for decades, that in just the past couple of years, robots or computers seem to be just as good, if not exceeding us. And I don't know if that's promising or worrisome. But anyhow, Carl, please, if you don't mind answering the question, and then we'll go Anna, then Bert, and then Dumas. Hear that sound? That's the sweet sound of success with Shopify. Shopify is the all-encompassing commerce platform that's with you from the first flicker of an idea to the moment you realize you're running a global enterprise. Whether it's handcrafted jewelry or high-tech gadgets, Shopify supports you at every point of sale, both online and in person. They streamline the process with the internet's best converting checkout, making it 36% more effective than other leading platforms. There's also something called Shopify Magic, your AI-powered assistant that's like an all-star team member working tirelessly behind the scenes. What I find fascinating about Shopify is how it scales with your ambition. No matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Join the ranks of businesses in 175 countries that have made Shopify the backbone of their commerce. Shopify, by the way, powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, including huge names like Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen. If you ever need help, their award-winning support is like having a mentor that's just a click away. Now, are you ready to start your own success story? Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theories, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theories now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/theories.
Actually, just reflecting upon your one of your observations, I think it's very difficult to identify one thing. What is impressive is the diversity of advances and applications. And I just say that because that's what I was thinking, you know, over the past 6 hours, just listening to your amazing presentation after presentation, and just, you know, noting how diverse, you know, and yet there's this common thread, this common commitment, basically sating our curiosity and using the tools that naturalize that kind of sense-making, curious behavior and communication that inherit from sort of either maths or category theory, or as Ralph notes now, quantum information theory. But just to pick up on a couple of things which are relevant to this conversation. So the work with Chris Fields, it sounds lovely and exciting to bring quantum mechanics into active inference, but that's not the move that I think Chris is really wanting to champion. The move, I think, is something that we've all been addressing in one way or another, which is leveraging the scale-free aspects of this principled approach to self-organization and hopefully self-organization to some kind of generalized synchrony. So that's where the quantum information theory gets into the game. It is scale free, and indeed he will go further and say it's completely background free and everything is constructed. It's just so I think that's a lovely move, because once you've gone scale free, you then start to ask deep questions about how you couple one scale to another scale. And in a sense, ecosystems is just that. How do the denizens of an ecosystem, how is it constituted? How is it co-constructed? What is the structure of it? These are all questions about how one scale links to another scale. So I think there have been lots of advances in that direction in many, many different fronts. And you can read that either in terms of coupling different sort of spatial or yeah, spatial scales, but probably more importantly, sort of temporal scales. And you see that, you know, wherever you look. You've just come back to what do you mean by a narrative? It is exactly, I think, as I said, it's just a plan. It's just a story. But notice the story has a temporal aspect to it. You know, I have narratives about being a good person, being a good father, being a good scientist. I also have narratives about, you know, I want my cup of coffee, or I have to go look after the, if I don't, but Ralph has to go look after the child. So, you know, we've all got narratives at very, very different timescales. And of course, if you're, you know, just going back to Bert's example of, you know, I'm an autonomous vehicle and I'm sentient and we're 5 years into the future and I have to drive around the roundabout. You know, what temporal scale and what kind of temporal coarse graining to define the narrative necessary with narratives would be appropriate for that kind of situation. The ensuing planning. So a short answer to your question, I think there have been many, many advances. I think what they've had in common is basically transcending either different domains, but in particular, different scales of application. I also agree with the notion, well, another, I think, important and pragmatic advance is something that Bert mentioned, which is the democratization of this technology. And I think Ralph also hinted at, you know, this is the time you start using this for the common good. So I think, you know, the things like RxInfer and PyMDP, and I didn't know about the Gaia project, but it sounds as though there's been great advances there as well. So this kind of democratization, I think, is really important, this sort of socialization where everybody can play and start to sort of not talk past each other. I think that's a very important advance.
And did you say the word scale invariance or scale independence?
I say scale invariant. I actually said scale free, and I shouldn't have done that. I said scale free. So the idea that you can apply exactly the same mechanics and literally, for example, say from Bert's perspective, the same kind of message passing at different space-time scales, or at different levels in a hierarchical model. So I've actually got a question for Bert in terms of reactive message passing, because reactive means that you don't have to prescribe the scheduling, but you in addressing the problems or the issues that are entailed by having to specify the scheduling of talking or of message passing, you're bound to deal with time, and in a scale invariant context or nested scales, for example, you have to deal with the separation of temporal scales. So I think there's going to be a very important generic question, which technically Bert have been thinking about furiously for the past few years, but I think implicitly we're all going to have to be addressing soon, which is the how do you put that, the timing of your messages, when you make a move or when you listen to a patient or when you actually pass a message in on a factograph, how are we going to be able to put the separation of time scales into the architecture in a way that speaks to this the scale invariance. You know, the Gaia project, for example, how do you integrate live feed from traffic flow sensors with fluctuations in the climate? You know, this kind of data comes at very, very different temporal scales and yet has to be assimilated and modeled. You know, in a way that is also, I think, has to pay due courtesy to that separation of temporal scales.
Bert, could you please recapitulate the question for the audience and then begin to answer it?
Okay. The issue is if active instance agents are nested agents, and the higher levels supposed to operate on a larger temporal scale, but they're also working at a lower resolution, right? If you look far ahead, you don't care as much about precision, not at a centimeter level. When I go around a roundabout, I don't care at the centimeter where I land, but for the next few milliseconds, I do care about, because it may mean the difference between getting in the ditch or not. So, I don't want to send, so the higher level, I want to look very deep ahead, but I don't want to send every millisecond a message to go to look, let's say, a minute ahead, because so I need to space it out a lot, but then I may miss things. So preferably you would just send inaccurate messages, but that only works if you actually have a method to also, let's say, use less computational power to compute a less accurate message. And we're not good at that yet. What we are thinking about is there's a new field, or a new field, but there's a field called probabilistic numerics, where we are used in math to just compute everything very precisely, or as precise as possible, and do not care about how much computation we spend on it. So in probabilistic numerics, I hope we can leverage this for massive computations. I would like to spend, let's say, proportionally less computational power on the accuracy of a message. One way possibly would be to consider a message a latent variable that has an uncertainty by itself. But I don't have a totally clear answer for Carl, because we haven't solved that either. But there is a problem in, let's say, what we do on our computers weren't so completely different from computers that from the brain we're spending just too many computations on messages that in the end are very, very inaccurate, and that's a problem in what we do on our computers currently. So I don't know how we go. I mean, what you want to do with this on a higher level, if you want to look maybe 10 times farther ahead and spend about the same amount of computation on the lower level, that's sort of the our goal. But we don't have an answer for that either at the moment.
And Anna, please feel free to comment on or ask a question to anyone.
I don't have anything to contribute, unfortunately, to how computers work. But I can tell you that this idea of temporal scales is something that we face often in our work with patients. For example, addicted patients are very focused on short-term rewards. And in fact, their ability to control how they feel in the moment that is partially what drives the addiction. So when I try to adopt your all's language of minimizing surprise or minimizing free entropy, that's one of the things that people are trying to do on a short-term time scale when they become addicted. So I have a young woman who is addicted to nitrous oxide, which has a very fast onset of intoxication over the order of seconds and a very fast offset. And she says that that's exactly what she likes about it, because she's controlling it second by second. So when we work with patients to get them out of that short temporal horizon, we actually rely more and more on action and having them change something in their lives, namely abstain from their drug of choice for long enough to kind of completely reset their brains and to allow them to see this longer temporal horizon. Because when they're chasing this short control, they're actually not able to see themselves in the longer narrative arc of their lives. So that's what comes to mind for me. I don't think it's going to be helpful to people who are trying to build computers, but that's the kinds of interventions that I make with humans.
I have a question about that. So you mentioned control and the short term, and you've also mentioned that you study the positive effects of having a higher power in your life, or surrender. Okay, I kind of gave the punchline away by saying surrendering to a higher power. Where I was going was, okay, what's the association between seeing yourself in the largest time frame and a higher power, And then also, is there something that is akin to giving up control when you look farther and farther into the future?
Such a great, that's really at the heart of what I'm very interested in, because it's a real paradox, right? It's this kind of locus of control within ourselves that really in modern culture we think is a great thing. But when that's taken to an extreme, and one example of that is addictive behaviors, it's very bad for people and for communities. And so what can pull people out of that is this kind of surrender to a higher power, giving up that locus of control, locating that locus of control outside themselves, not mm-hmm. necessarily like in a theistic sense. One of the things, that they talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, is, you don't have to believe in God. It's just not you. You're not driving it. And so I would be very curious from the perspective of your all's understanding of active inference and the free energy principle and how the brain works. Why is it that sort of embracing our inability to control what happens in our lives can actually be the very source of healing, especially embedded in this really kind of over-controlled, I would even go so far as to say endemically narcissistic culture. Like, I'm really curious. I don't want to take the conversation, in a direction.
Please. That's a fantastic question. So if anyone has a comment on that, please.
Oh, I have some thoughts. and I think this applies both at the personal level and at the global level. And I think it has to do with the my quote from earlier, by Edward Fulbrook, that if you're falling from a plane, yes, maybe an altimeter and some instruments might be useful, but what you really need is a parachute, right? So we have this presupposition that our whatever like framing we have operating in our day-to-day is going to be, okay, this is the right framing, and it tends to be this rational scientific framing of okay, very very linear cause and consequence for most stuff. And it turns out that even like if you inspect our day-to-day behavior, bigger, more complicated models are not necessarily better, which is where we get the success of heuristics under a bounded computation, bounded rationality. If you scale it up to 8 billion humans interacting in a resource-constrained planet, a world of possibilities, but also of challenges, then we have to like drastically lower our bar for, yes, how much control we have, but also even like how much, where does information gathering reach diminishing returns? Where does modeling reach diminishing returns? There's a whole literature in the business world about the expected value of information, how much you should actually invest. Like, also in science is also known as optimal experiment design, where basically, acknowledging that you have limited budget in terms of how much you can act and how much you can probe and how much time you can spend thinking about stuff. And I think what we're doing when we feel like burned out or exhausted from overthinking, we're innately feeling that okay, we've gone too high and we need to give ourselves a vacation, give ourselves some free time here. I think that doing this in a principled way, we're just not just like taking the heuristics and the signals that we inherit from evolution, but actually being able to figure out collaboratively and with some rigor, okay, this is we don't need to know exactly how many degrees the world is going to warm by 2100 in order to know that maybe it's a good idea to start doing something about the amount of carbon in the atmosphere or whatever, right? And so I think this leads to this knowledge, this idea of a real knowledge economy and of things like abstraction as a service. How can you actually build in this kinds of like sophisticated and sophisticated translation layers that take some of this burden from ourselves as individuals and even as organizations, right? And just put it out in the world as value-added services, which is what they are.
Hear that sound? That's the sweet sound of success with Shopify. Shopify is the all-encompassing commerce platform that's with you from the first flicker of an idea to the moment you realize you're running a global enterprise. Whether it's handcrafted jewelry or high-tech gadgets, Shopify supports you at every point of sale, both online and in person. They streamline the process with the internet's best converting checkout, making it 36% more effective than other leading platforms. There's also something called Shopify Magic, your AI-powered assistant that's like an all-star team member working tirelessly behind the scenes. What I find fascinating about Shopify is how it scales with your ambition. No matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Join the ranks of businesses in 175 countries that have made Shopify the backbone of their commerce. Shopify, by the way, powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, including huge names like Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen. If you ever need help, their award-winning support is like having a mentor that's just a click away. Now, are you ready to start your own success story? Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theories, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theories now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/theories.
And Guillaume, if you have any statements or questions or retorts, then please feel free.
Thanks. Now I was Still, also thinking about the recent breakthrough post 2020 in active inference. To me, like there were like theoretical progress that were very interesting. We heard already about the formalism maturity at the mathematical level between multi-scale and scale-free aspects. I really liked also the development of a more multi-agent perspective of active inference. That's very interesting. Especially like, for instance, the seeing multi-agent systems, we have just heard like even society as a whole, like as many as one system or many as many subsystems, and how we can use maybe those formalisms to also deal with policymaking. That's very interesting venue. And the emergence of norms, culture, and ideas also, because One thing that I'm still struggling with in the case of active inference models is like how to get outside the checkerboard. You can put a lot in the model a priori, and how you make the model creating new stuff that is not baked inside at the first. And on that, one very interesting breakthrough was the application of active inference to morphogenesis. I really like the work that has been done on that. And on the technical aspects, I think the two main focus that I love are all the deep active inference and how to scale up active inference, because it's a strong limitation for the adoption of the formalism if it's not scaled enough compared to other framework like deep learning. And then the link with empirical data. I really like, for instance, the work of Ryan Smith and how to connect with electrophysiology and clinical data. And I think it's also something very important to anchor the theory in the real world and have like a falsifiability and empirical validation of those models.
And what are some of the applications of active inference to morphogenesis?
So, well, I'm not the expert here. Carl would be the best to answer that. But I was referring to the work with Michael Levin and how a model can help to create a sort of embryogenesis. So maybe Carl, you can explain better than me.
Please.
Yeah. I don't have a reputation for explaining things very clearly. but yeah, that's absolutely right. It was just at work with Mike Levin and colleagues showing that you can get quite expressive and biomimetic pattern formation and movement of different cells into an organization, often described in terms of morphogenesis, simply by communicating your beliefs. So I'm coming back to this sort of cross-cutting theme of communication. So if you just broadcast your beliefs and you're a little cell, and you have, and there are a little ensemble of cells, and they all have the shared generative model that includes, if I was in this position, I would sense that. Now, they all have exactly the same generative model, the same predictions, the same expectations, and they're all broadcasting their beliefs about where they are. And the free energy minimizing solution is just when they're all in a place that they such that they receive signals that they would expect to receive when they're in this place. And of course, if that is the same for everybody, there's only one arrangement where each cell finds its place. So basically, it's just knowing your place is an emergent property of making the world mutually predictable through communication. So it's a deflationary account of morphogenesis. But Guillaume, I thought, you know, one of your units is precision psychiatry. So I thought you were going to talk about precision. So I'm going to do a Guillaume now. He talked about morphogenesis. I'm going to talk about precision now. I think that's a really nice way just to pick up on themes which everybody's just mentioned, in particular the pathology of precision. And by precision, you can read precision in the sense that Bert was talking about in terms of, do you use an unsigned integer or a double? You know, how much can I coarse grain to my numeric representation? Or you can use it in terms of coarse graining in the sense of the renormalization group. You know, it's just chunking things in hours or years as opposed to milliseconds and minutes. Or you can look at it in terms of a statistician describing the reliability or the inverse variance of a signal. And of course, we have to estimate that. When I say we, I mean your agents and statisticians, and act accordingly. And certainly in the work of Brian Smith on addiction, much of the sort of mathematical explanation for these addictive, locked-in, OCD-like phenomena rests upon a failure to get that coarse grading, that precision estimation right. The reason I wonder whether it'd be just worthwhile revisiting addiction and psychopathology, or certainly pathology of behavior, from the point of view of getting precision wrong, and certainly assigning too much precision to low-level processing, which is what Bert wants to avoid doing. It just strikes me that that kind of story also has mileage in terms of why we are in a state of paralysis when it comes to climate change. Because I also noticed, Guillaume, that you talked about climate action. I never heard that before, but that seems to me to be the important thing. Why isn't there any climate action? And Anna, you know, what it would be like you going to the clinic and finding someone with Parkinson's disease. Why isn't this person moving? You know, and interestingly, the computational explanation for Parkinson's disease is assigning too much precision to the evidence that you're not moving before you move. So, you know, if you can't ignore the fact that nothing is changing, all your prior beliefs, your predictions that I am going to stand up or I'm going to initiate walking, don't get a look at because they are immediately cancelled because you've assigned too much precision to the lower level processing. And I'm just wondering whether that's something that kind of pathology is exactly what Ralph is trying to reverse by having, you know, models at hand, recommendations at hand that provide a more coarse-grained view of things, a deeper view.
Anna, would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, well, I love this idea of the pathology of precision, because I think it manifests in so many different ways, you know, not just among my patient population, but I think it's almost like a cultural sickness in a way. you know, the ways in which we seem like obsessed with certain types of data and we're missing the big picture. So I'm gonna think more about that. I'm gonna read more about it. I really appreciate the discussion. It's interesting for me.
And Anna, when you're referring to the pathology of precision, do you mean so in a more conscious sense that we're over-evaluating something that we don't need to? Whereas Carl, you're referring to it in an unconscious sense, like the brain is putting too much precision on something, because in Parkinson's, it's not like you consciously are putting precision in a place.
Well, I think you could look at it sort of like in both cases. When I think about addiction, you know, people aren't doing it consciously. It's that they really do see this as adaptive and healthy, and also even on some level they can't do otherwise. And they're not able to see the true impact of their drug use on their lives. They're genuinely not able to see the negative consequences. I mean, that's what contributes to getting caught in that vortex. But I mean, you could also see it as part of what's happened culturally. Like, for example, like the whole wellness industrial complex, the way that we now count ourselves, you know, through all these different devices. And if we could just count our breathing and count our heart rate and take supplements, you know, then we would somehow reach some levitating state of precise wellness. And so, I don't know. I mean, you know, just kind of this is all kind of new ideas for me.
That's interesting. So you believe that we can be inundated with health data and that's detrimental to us?
Oh, absolutely. I see that all the time.
Uh-huh. So for me, I used to have, maybe I'll take this out of the, let me figure out how to say this diplomatically. I used to have a device that would measure my heart rate, let's say that, and my sleep. And instead of improving my sleep, it led to me becoming obsessed with it and then noticing, oh, I didn't sleep well. I must not be feeling good today as well, because apparently there's a high connection between how your sleep quality and
that's
how well
exactly
you feel.
It. Plus, added to that, the other layer that I should be able to control it, right? So with all of this data and information, I should be able to, I don't know, reduce free entropy or whatever, how it's reduced surprise, as you guys talk about. You know, and I think that's obviously, that only goes so far and then can actually contribute to our misery, because why aren't we all, you know, levitating like the Buddha or whatever, you know, when we have all these tools and we can pay attention to all this data. So
I see this also with people who have productivity tools, and not only that, but mechanical keyboards, let's say. The reason why I don't have a mechanical keyboard, even though I think I'd love it, is because I know that, why the heck do I care about the clicking sound of a keyboard? But if I got one, then I'd be like, well, what's the difference between clicking sound A versus clicking sound B versus clicking sound C? And I'd become obsessed with the trappings of productivity, that is sharpening, so-called sharpening the axe, rather than cutting down the tree. There's this phrase that is apocryphal, and it's attributed to Lincoln, which is that he'd spend 80% of his time, or half the time, sharpening the knife than cutting the tree. And then this is just echoed in productivity circles, but It can't be the case. Why would you spend so much time sharpening your axe? Like, look at anyone who cuts down a tree with an axe. Most of the time, they're not doing that. Anyhow, so if anyone has any comments on what was just said, please.
Can I just talk what I find exciting in my field about
axe? Sure, yes.
It was a long time ago, but there was a paper, and it's about that. It says, active inference is not really a scientific loop because it's biased. And I read that, and the sound of the paper was kind of, so it's not good. But I think, you know, active inference is maybe not a science loop. It's an engineering loop, because there's bias, and we need bias in engineering. We need to make stuff. We need to build stuff. We need to have a bias. So it's an engineering design cycle. I see that everywhere around me. And active inference could be a complete breakthrough in engineering, right? The fields around me are signal processing. I am myself in a signal processing department or group, and everybody builds algorithms. For us, I mean, in active inference agents, it's inference over states. then the floor below me, they build control systems. Well, it's inference over actions. Then other people are working on machine learning. It's inference over parameters. Active inference could be, and you'll like this, Kurt, it's a very deflationary view on engineering, because everything is just inference. And so rather than building algorithms everywhere, if we become really good at implementing energy minimization, we will be able to build a great engineering design cycles, and we'll be engineering better machines for medical procedures or for other things that are important. So it has a tremendous application potential in engineering. In engineering, I think in many fields, people have sort of drifted in different directions. Control theorists they do almost the same thing as signal processing people, but they speak a different language now. And, and signal processing people, it's a completely different group from the machine learning people, but it's all information processing. And this brings it, this field can bring it together. I think it's, but the thing is that in order to make it successful in engineering, we need to build an application that impresses, right? That it's not like a tic-tac-toe thing. That it really needs to impress people. It needs to be better than some other control systems. But once we do that, I think there is tremendous application potential, because there haven't been enormous breakthroughs in signal processing and control. The last big breakthrough, I think, was Kalman filtering, and this was 1960s. And I mean, it's kind of funny that the essence of what we do in active inference is also Kalman filtering. So, I think there's tremendous opportunities for what we do here for engineering. So that's why it's exciting to me.
Anna, do you mind expanding on what you said about acting and therapists should be helping their patients with that?
Oh, sure. One of my critiques of mental health treatment today is that there's not enough encouragement of patients to actually go and act differently in the world as a way of gathering data. Instead, it often ends up being kind of this world building between therapists and patients, not necessarily ultimately adaptive in the world. So I was really just kind of responding to what Rav was saying, that we need to act in the world. I think that's more true now in modern rich nations than ever before, because we are so incredibly sedentary and interacting. Of course, we're interacting with a virtual world, and that's, good and bad. But I mean, I think we need to be actually acting in the world.
Hmm. And so there's different forms of therapy, as you know. There's talk therapy, and then there's also cognitive behavioral therapy or psychotherapy instead of talk therapy. But cognitive behavioral therapy, as far as I understand, focuses on the actions. Is that incorrect?
I mean, for treating addiction, like you're not going to really get that far with cognitive behavioral therapy or anything that's focused on just emotions and cognitions. People have to go out and actually try stopping their substance or their addictive behaviors and gather data from that experience and then come back and process it.
Mm-hmm. So Anna, in your field, and this question will go to everyone, in your field, in what you study, where is the largest gap that you would like to see closed?
Well, I mean, we're facing a huge mental health crisis. Now we have more and more young people coming in with depression, anxiety, suicidality, addictions of all sorts. And these are not necessarily people who are struggling by virtue of trauma or socioeconomic disparity. These are people who have really privileged lives in many instances. So it's really a puzzle, what is going on for people. And I think a big part of it is the fact that people are not having embodied experiences. They're not having experiences in the world. And also the experiences that they are having are, these kinds of very quick fixes and fast pleasures. So I think, the co-created sort of models through healthier communication that allow people to feel part of a community and also to have like truthful co-created narratives, trying to use the language here. I think that's really important. So for example, one of the things, and Bert mentioned what he's excited about, one of the things I'm excited about in the field of addiction medicine is mutual support and the proliferation of things like Alcoholics Anonymous, but also other mutual help groups, a lot of them existing now online, and the way that people are together creating healthier narratives and acted together to counteract a lot of the unhealthy narratives that I think are driving a lot of decision-making today.
I wanted to know, is there a correlation between the rise in mental illness or mental health issues, whatever we want to call it, and a certain trait of people? Like, is it affecting the population the same? So the whole population is raised 20% in terms of how many mental health issues they have per year. Or is it affecting people who deal with abstractions more and more? So for instance, we're talking over Zoom and some people study abstractions just like us. And then there's some people whose work it is to do something physical, like running or swim. Like, is it affecting everyone equally? Or are you noticing that there's some broad trend?
Well, the broad trends that are out there are just correlational, but the more time that people spend in the virtual world, the more likely they are to suffer from depression, anxiety, and other mental health problems. People haven't really been able to narrow that down to specific content, but they have been able to say just the sheer amount of time that you're spending online increases your risk for certain mental health, poor mental health outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Again, if anyone has any comments or questions, please just raise your physical hand. I can see that. And okay, Raphael, sorry.
I was just going to say that I think another notable trend is that, and I just saw somebody say this on YouTube just yesterday, that young people are disproportionately affected by things like climate grief because they're the ones that are going to be alive to deal with it. I think that applies more generally, that Peter Senge already like 30 years or something ago wrote about the inescapable network of neutrality, reality that what we do affects each other, right? And we took advantage of this huge resource buffer that's called the biosphere and Earth to pretend that it didn't for quite a long time, and got a lot of mileage out of it. But now we're at a point where there's a whole generation of people that are coming to grips with the fact that I'm going to stop myself from saying a swear word, but oh my God, we actually need to change everything about everything that we do. And we need to do it fast. And by the way, it's not just what we do it's not just what we do out there. It's also what we do inside, how we get ready for how to show up for life internally, right? So no wonder that it impacts on myself. I've dealt with anxiety and a lot of other things. We've had conversations about what are we doing bringing a daughter into this world and all these kinds of things. I think it's only natural that it's coming to a head in this way right now.
Guillaume, you have your hand up and I can't see you.
Yes. It's connect with what has just been said. So, and your initial question about the gaps that needs to be closed, I think like a scale-free model of health and mental health particularly would be great. Like we are in silos in biomedical research, and the fact that someone is having depression can come from interacting genes as much as interacting people, and also is related to climate change and so on. So how we can have a new health systems that doesn't deal with those silos and integrate those different scales, to me it's like really a big challenge, but a challenge that current models and work that we can see go in that direction, and I'm very enthusiastic about that.
And Bert?
The Well, in my field in engineering, active inference is not understood because almost all papers are written by neuroscientists and they're hard to read. So I was really happy to hear today that, and I think it's Sanjeev Namjoshi who is writing an engineering book on active inference. So that will, I think that will really help. That together with the availability of good toolboxes for implementing active inference should make a lot of engineers much more enthusiastic about active inference, because that's it's not something that is it's not understood at the moment in engineering circles. So I hope that the book will be good. That I'm enthusiastic about that.
And Carl, where are some gaps in the research that you'd like to see addressed?
There are all the gaps. There's a whole empty space out there yet to be explored. But in terms of what seems to be emerging from the session and specifically the past few answers, it does seem to be important to have this very generic, just to take Bert's sort of line, that this is just one deflationary, simple, and probably the right way to understand stuff and to make recommendations or to describe people's actions, possibly to themselves in a therapeutic context. And as such, it should be push button technology and it should be democratized and socialized. And I think that's the challenge practically. And one may ask, why would you want to do that? For me, there are two clear imperatives. One is very abstract and it's not really my within my comfort zone, and the other one is in my comfort zone, but the one that's outside my comfort zone is this notion of interactivity and hyperconnectivity in the and the meta crisis that we heard about. And Guillaume also referred to this in terms of what he was trying to distinguish between a Californian notion of optimality and another way forward. And to me, it's you know, a stark contrast with growth is good versus sustainability. And of course, the maths of the free energy principle is just about sustainability. It's just a description of the physics of systems, random dynamical systems that self-organize to some non-equilibrium steady state. And that is what we are. So, you know, for me, there's something deeply, if you like, apt about the free energy principle and its corollaries, such as active inference, in application to ecosystems and lived ecosystems and realized ecosystems. So if those basic principles can be brought back into globalization, into the market, into fintech, into social media, into politics, into climate action, I think that would be a good thing. I'm just mindful of, this struck me in a number of the presentations today. If you remember before, Bert was saying, if you look at the brain, which is a really lovely example of a self-organizing system to a non-equilibrium steady state, then it's empty. And what did he mean by that? Well, he didn't mean you're empty-headed. What he meant was it's incredibly sparsely connected. Now, that tells you immediately that a pathology of connectivity is hyperconnectivity, overconnectivity, which immediately, it made me very alert to the presentation of the meta crisis, that one of the first three things that was underwrote the meta crisis, or the current crisis we're contending with, is a destruction of that sparse, delicate connectivity that defines thingness and defines ensembles of things, technically in terms of Markov blankets. So if we want a world in which lots of different things can coexist in some kind of generalized synchrony in a sustainable way, mm-hmm. you need sparse connectivity. And the pathology, the thing that will destroy that, is over connectivity. So it seems to me very important that we get that into play in terms of machine learning, artificial intelligence, politics, fintech, climate change. And the only way it's going to get there is epistemically by equipping people to actually build their own little models and ask their own questions. You can't tell people this. They're going to learn. They're going to learn it for themselves. Just very quickly, because I'm sure we've only got a couple of minutes left. The other agenda, which I'm more familiar with, is exactly Anna's and Guillaume's agenda, which is making this work in the context of neurology and psychiatry. So if you can democratize and socialize this way of describing things so that people can now build models of their particular patient in the other use of precision psychiatry, I suspect that Guillaume's unit was called after. So it's a personalized medicine that is really personalized in the sense that you actually have your digital twin of your behavior. And then you've got that, you optimize your digital twin to become a model of your patient. And then you can start to do experiments on that model, behavioral interventions, or even share that model very much in the spirit of CBT with the patient and say, look, this is you. This is what would happen if you went out and did this. And this is what would happen if you went out and did that. That to my mind, and indeed that was the initial motivation for much of this work, was actually to build observation models of psychiatric conditions to work out both the pharmacological and physiological basis and the disruption of the pathology of precision and message passing on the factographs that are our brain, even though they are very empty on the one hand, but also get that behavior, that key thing that Anna was talking about, that active engagement with the lived world into that model, and hence active inference. And just to conclude, that activity, that sort of physical engagement, that embodiment, that sort of 4Es and everything else, I think it's really coming to a head now in terms of people's, after the large language model, after the ChatGPT moment, the bounce back has been, what's missing? What's not there? And of course, what is not there is agency and embodied engagement with the world. And that's why I think there's still a lot of work to be done in bringing artificial intelligence read as active inference to in a way that matters to people who can make a difference, which is basically everybody, but specifically politicians and doctors and the engineers and the like.
So you all now have 30 seconds to 60 seconds to speak directly to the audience. What closing message do you have? You're speaking directly to someone who's listening. They're a curious person. They're interested in active inference. They also want to lead better lives, hopefully, and do something propitious. So what message do you have for them? Anna, we'll start with you.
Gosh, I'm just going to say what pops into my mind right now is that one of the things I have learned from my patients who are trying to get into recovery from severe addictions is something that they call the set-aside prayer, where they set aside all of the notions that they have about how the world works and try to be completely open and receptive to information coming into their minds. And I think that's just a wonderful frame or concept for all of us living in the world to periodically just take a moment and take these models and just say, everything I think I know about the world, I'm going to temporarily suspend it and I'm just going to be open. And when that happens, we can be present and learn in a way that it's not possible when we're just trying to reinforce our models.
Great. Fantastic. And Bert, and then we'll go Carl, and then Raph, and then Guillaume.
I just enjoyed today very much. I thought there was a lot of material both for people from, let's say, psychology, neuroscience, but also for engineers. So if you haven't watched some of the talks, go look through the schedule, because some of the talks were really good, I think. So I really enjoyed that. And then, yeah, what should I tell people? Go work out. Do a lot of sports. It's good for you.
Mm-hmm. Carl.
Yeah. Sorry, I was going to make a joke, but I can't because it wouldn't be pretty. So I'm going to use my 30 seconds just to thank Daniel and his team for this. So if you want something to do, you should go and watch the live streams. Get involved with this ecosystem. I hadn't seen that paper being presented before, but I was really impressed with the sort of the Active Inference Institute and its openness and its welcoming attitude and vision, like the Smithsonian. So if you want to pursue these ideas, get involved. And if you haven't got time, just make sure you attend next year's Active Inference Institute celebration. But thank you, Daniel.
Raphael?
Yeah, so I'll second what Carl said and follow on with it's an invitation not just to participate in the Active Inference Institute, but also an invitation to participate in building this this Gaia tractor, this new way of doing things that acknowledges the value of growth. And also the value of sustainability, joins it all together in this thing called regeneration. And it really is a collective effort, it's a collective learning effort. So and this also, by the way, also applies to the panelists as well. Obviously, what Bird and Carl are doing, it has immediate things having to have to do with. What we're after, but one of the main things that we discussed, that we keep discussing, is also like this: the intersubjectivity and the importance of being able to operate well as humans together, and that connects directly to cognitive science, psychiatry, and so Guillaume so everybody that wants to be engaged and be a part of building a better world should be thinking about what am I doing with my, as an individual or as an employee of an organization or as a researcher or as a leader, or the family member, what am I doing? How does it contribute to this, this new non-equilibrium set of state? So yeah, that's kind of it. I probably blew through the 60 seconds, but here it is.
And Guillaume.
Well, I would thanks also all of you for the discussion and the organizer for what they are doing. Indeed, like the work of the Active Inference Institute is very laudable and interesting from an open science perspective. They are really embodying that. So big kudos to them. And Bert De Vries was saying to do sport is good for you. I'm not very good at sports, but some say that science is a team sport. So at least have a good team perspective when doing science and being kind to each other would be the best advice to everyone.
Well, thank you all. I also would like
you get yours too. Somebody else has to come in from outside the Markov blanket, though.
Well, I wanted to just thank you, Daniel. Thank you, Daniel and Raphael. And also Carl and Anna and Bert and Guillaume. This was a tremendous amount of fun. I hope I get to speak to you all individually. As usual, I have way more questions than we were able to get to. Thank you all.
Thanks, Eric.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Firstly, thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. There's now a website, kurtjaimungal.org, and that has a mailing list. The reason being that large platforms like YouTube, like Patreon, they can disable you for whatever reason, whenever they like. That's just part of the terms of service. Now, a direct mailing list ensures that I have an untrammeled communication with you. Plus, soon I'll be releasing a one-page PDF of my top 10 toes. It's not as Quentin Tarantino as it sounds like. Secondly, if you haven't subscribed or clicked that like button, now is the time to do so. Why? Because each subscribe, each like helps YouTube push this content to more people like yourself. Plus, it helps out Kurt directly, aka me.
I also found out last year that external links count plenty toward the algorithm, which means that whenever you share on Twitter, say on Facebook or even on Reddit, etc., it shows YouTube, hey, people are talking about this content outside of YouTube, which in turn greatly aids the distribution on YouTube. Thirdly, there's a remarkably active Discord and subreddit for Theories of Everything, where people explicate toes, they disagree respectfully about theories, and build as a community our own toe. Links to both are in the description. Fourthly, you should know this podcast is on iTunes, it's on Spotify, it's on all of the audio platforms. All you have to do is type in Theories of Everything and you'll find it. Personally, I gain from rewatching lectures and podcasts. I also read in the comments that, hey, toe listeners also gain from replaying. So how about instead you re-listen on those platforms like iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whichever podcast catcher you use. And finally, if you'd like to support more conversations like this, more content like this, then do consider visiting patreon.com/KurtJMungle and donating with whatever you like. There's also PayPal. There's also crypto. There's also just joining on YouTube. Again, keep in mind, it's support from the sponsors and you that allow me to work on Toe full time. You also get early access to ad-free episodes, whether it's audio or video. It's audio in the case of Patreon, video in the case of YouTube. For instance, this episode that you're listening to right now was released a few days earlier. Every dollar helps far more than you think. Either way, your viewership is generosity enough. Thank you so much.